From executive producer Isaac Saul, this is Tangle.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the Tangle Podcast, the place we get views from across the political spectrum, some independent thinking, and a little bit of my take. I'm your host, Isaac Saul, and on today's episode, we're going to be talking about the campus protests happening across the country, but primarily with a focus on Columbia University, which has been very much in the news the last couple of weeks. I've got some pretty strong feelings about a lot of the stuff that's been going on, including this sense that I don't know why this is getting as much attention as it is, which I'm going to talk about in my take, but it is. And this story is everywhere, and it's all I'm seeing people talk about on social media. And, you know, even in my personal life, people are talking about it and asking about it. And it's on the home pages of all the major newspapers. It's being covered by all the major news networks. So it's something we can't really ignore as much as part of me would like to. So we're going to jump in and talk a little bit about that. And we're skipping the reader question today because my take gets a little long. But we've got some quick hits and our under the radar story, which I think is really important as far as under the radar stories go, and all our usual fare. So hope you guys enjoy, and we'll jump right in with some quick hits as always. First up, the United States Senate passed the House's package of $95 billion of aid for Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan by a 79-18 vote, with 15 Republicans voting against the package. The Senate also approved a divestment or ban of TikTok. Number two, publisher David Pecker took the stand in former President Donald Trump's criminal trial yesterday, detailing a 2015 agreement he made with Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, to purchase and kill negative stories about Trump during the 2016 election. Number three, the United States Justice Department settled claims with 139 women over the FBI's mishandling of sexual abuse allegations against former USA Gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar. The DOJ will pay $139 million. Number four, a Russian court rejected the latest appeal from Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, meaning he will remain imprisoned until at least this summer. And number five, former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the Democrat from California, called for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to resign, saying he was an obstacle to a two-state solution.
A stunning scene at Columbia University in New York today. Police in riot gear moving in to clear an encampment of students protesting the war in Gaza. Dozens arrested.
It's been nearly a week of demonstrations at the Columbia University campus.
More than 100 students have been arrested so far, and pro-Palestinian demonstrators have been demanding a ceasefire in Gaza and are upset about the school's handling of the conflict.
Columbia University in New York is extending this morning's deadline for an encampment of student protesters to disperse. Pro-Palestinian demonstrations have erupted on the campus over the war in Gaza. A spokesperson says the university is making progress in talks with students and will continue these conversations for the next 2 days.
Over the last week, protests on elite college campuses over Israel's war in Gaza have boiled over, with hundreds of students arrested or suspended, and clashes between protesters and counter-protesters hitting a fever pitch. A flashpoint has been Columbia University on the Upper West Side of New York, where student protests have a long and storied history. In 1968, a brutal crackdown on student protesters led the school to adopt reforms that favor student activism. Apartheid Divest, a coalition of student groups organizing the protests, has demanded that the school financially divest from companies and institutions that profit from Israeli apartheid, genocide, and occupation in Palestine, as the group put it. It has also demanded an academic boycott of Israeli universities, reparations and low-income housing for Harlem residents, an end to targeted repression of Palestinian students, the defunding of public safety services on campus, and a call for a ceasefire in Gaza from the university. As tensions rose on campus, the university updated some of its policies to limit protests to certain times and designated areas on campus. Then, last Thursday, more than 100 students were arrested after the university called in the New York Police Department to clear out an encampment of pro-Palestinian demonstrators. Manoush Shafiq, Columbia's president, described the demonstrations as unauthorized and said the protesters had been warned several times to disperse, but were violating campus rules about when and where demonstrations were allowed. Last week, Shafiq testified before a House committee saying the school's policies on student protests were initially not up to the scale of this challenge. The NYPD, who arrived in riot gear and with zip ties, cleared out the encampment with little incident. Among the students arrested was Yisra Hirsi, the daughter of Representative Ilhan Omar, the Democrat from Minnesota. While Shafiq hoped to turn the temperature down and normalize campus life, the decision to arrest and disperse the protesters instead started a new firestorm. Student activists responded by setting up a large new encampment on campus and were joined by throngs of protesters unaffiliated with the school, some of whom were filmed calling for violence or making anti-Semitic comments. Hundreds of faculty members then held a mass walkout on Monday in solidarity with the students who were arrested, while Israeli professor Shai Davidai said he was barred from entering campus by officials who told him they couldn't ensure his safety after trying to lead a pro-Jewish rally. A campus rabbi urged Jewish students to go home early for Passover, saying campus was no longer safe. And on Tuesday, the school announced it was offering remote classes for the rest of the semester due to campus unrest. Meanwhile, college students on campuses across the country rallied in support of the arrested Columbia students. Dozens of protesters at Yale and New York University were also arrested, while the gates of Harvard were closed to the public. There were also reports of students setting up their own encampments at MIT, Tufts, Emerson, the University of Michigan, the University of Minnesota, and the University of California, Berkeley. Today, we're going to examine some arguments about these protests and their aftermaths from the left and the right, and then my take. We'll be right back after this quick commercial break. First up, we'll start with what the left is saying. The left has varying views on the protests, but many defend them against accusations of anti-Semitism. Some say the students' tactics are undermining their cause. Others say the students are taking a stand for a just cause. In New York Magazine, Sarah Jones said student protesters are schooling their universities. Difficult or controversial moments tend to reveal an institution's true commitments, and universities like Columbia, it seems, don't value critical thought as much as they value business as usual, Jones wrote. Administrators should perhaps use the intellectual skills that students themselves are expected to learn. It is patently unreasonable to equate all anti-Zionist political activity with anti-Semitism when many of the demonstrators are Jewish themselves. Any protest can attract bad actors, but that's no reason to stop organizing. As long as students remain peaceful, they are guilty of one thing only, embarrassing their universities by applying their education to the real world. At Columbia, they are not calling for violence, but for the university to divest from companies that profit from Israeli occupation, and they have good reason to do so. As pundits wring their hands over the protests, students remind onlookers that the real horror is not on the American campus, but in Gaza. In the New York Times, John McWhorter wrote, "I'm a Columbia professor. The protests on my campus are not justice. I thought about what would have happened if protesters were instead chanting anti-Black slogans or even something like, 'DEI has got to die,' to the same sound-off tune that 'From the River to the Sea' has been adapted to. They would have lasted roughly 5 minutes before masses of students shouted them down and drove them off campus. Why do so many people think that weeks-long campus protests against not just the war in Gaza, but Israel's very existence are nevertheless permissible?" McWhorter said. "Calling all this peaceful stretches the use of the word rather implausibly. It's an odd kind of peace when a local rabbi urges Jewish students to go home as soon as possible, when an Arab-Israeli activist is roughed up on Broadway, when the angry chanting becomes so constant that you almost start not to hear it, and it starts to feel normal to see posters and clothing portraying Hamas as heroes," McWhorter wrote. "I myself think the war on Gaza is no longer constructive or even coherent. However, the issues are complex in ways that this uncompromising brand of power battling is ill-suited to address." In The Guardian, Robert Reich argued that protesting against slaughter, as students in the U.S. are doing, isn't anti-Semitism. "Protesting against this slaughter is not expressing anti-Semitism. It is not engaging in hate speech. It is not endangering Jewish students. it is doing what should be done on a college campus, taking a stand against a perceived wrong, thereby provoking discussion and debate, Reich wrote. The Israel-Hamas war is horrifying. The atrocities committed by both sides illustrate the capacities of human beings for inhumanity and show the vile consequences of hate. For these reasons, it presents an opportunity for students to re-examine their preconceptions and learn from one another. The mission of a university is to coach students in how to learn, not to tell them what to think. It is to invite debate, not suppress it. Truth is a process and method, more verb than noun, Reich added, which is why universities should encourage and protect unpopular views. It's why unpopular speakers should be invited and welcomed to campus, and why peaceful demonstrations should be encouraged, not shut down. It is never appropriate to call in armed police to arrest peaceful student demonstrators. All right, that is it for the left is saying, which brings us to what the right is saying. The right is angered by the protests and argued that they aren't protected by the First Amendment. Some suggest today's universities are fomenting hate among students. Others equate the protests to past anti-Semitic rallies. The Wall Street Journal editorial board argued that anti-Israel protesters invoke a First Amendment they don't understand. Universities are supposed to be places where students and faculty can debate politics and other subjects without fear or censure. As the anti-Israel protests spread at Columbia, Yale, Harvard, New York University, and elsewhere, however, progressives are claiming that any restriction on the protesters is a violation of free speech. That isn't true, and it's important to understand why, the board wrote. The First Amendment doesn't apply to private citizens or institutions except in rare instances where they're acting as government agents. Columbia's code of conduct says a person violates the rules who engages in conduct that places another in danger of bodily harm or uses words that threaten bodily harm in a situation where there is clear and present danger of such bodily harm, the board said. Protesters also don't have a right to assemble on school property to disrupt the functioning of the university or intimidate students on the way to class. Even at a public university, all these rules would constitute reasonable restrictions on the time, place, and manner of speech. In the Washington Examiner, Zachary Faria wrote that elite colleges are molding a new generation of hateful people. These universities are either fiending outrage over those protests or are simply run by people who are too foolish to understand that their ideology is what created this environment. These universities have embraced the diversity, equity, and inclusion ideology that colors the world through oppressors and oppressed. The worldview places Palestinian terrorists firmly in the perennially oppressed category, Faria said. Columbia has fostered the very environment that leads to anti-Semitic students thinking they have a right and even a moral obligation to harass Jewish students. These universities are helping to mold the next generation of Americans into hateful anti-Semites and racists, urging them to view the world through these oppressor-oppressed narratives based on people's skin colors or, in these cases, people's Palestinian or Jewish identities. The common through line with these protests and anti-Semitic threats is that they are occurring on college campuses and being perpetrated by college students. The universities bear a lot of responsibility for encouraging this behavior and fostering these environments. In Town Hall, Matt Vespa said the left gets its own Charlottesville. These rallies may not have tiki torches, but the hatred of Jews emanating from these demonstrations is not so dissimilar from the right-wing goons who gathered in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017 and chanted, "Jews will not replace us." The only difference is that neo-Nazism in America is an extreme minority, Vespa wrote. The pro-Hamas army we're dealing with is comprised of not just college students, but urban professionals, actors, and other influential figures that dominate America's cultural centers. Colleges are the factories where the next generation of leaders are being educated, and they all hate Jews in Israel. The media can't ignore this either. It's happening in their backyard, where their headquarters are located, and where they tap to get new hires and interns for the summer. They're all anti-Jewish, anti-Israel bigots who apparently can't wait to see another October 7th-like attack from Hamas, Vespa wrote. There's no hiding the hatred of Jews, the pro-Hamas advocacy among the crowds, and the president trying to walk a path of denouncing the rally so as not to lose Jewish Democrats or the young voters who are as bloodthirsty as the radical Islamic terrorists we're trying to defeat. All right, that is it for what the left and the right are saying, which brings us to my take. So it's gotten so tough for me to organize my thoughts on this, that instead of just trying to draft one cohesive my take, I'm going to share just 12 independent thoughts that I have had in reaction to this story and what we're watching unfold. Number one, I have to be honest about something. I'm really starting to hate writing about anything related to Israel or Gaza. It feels like I can't talk to you authentically about this latest controversy without just acknowledging that first. I've done this podcast and this newsletter for 5 days a week for nearly 5 years, covering COVID, abortion, gun control, trans issues, immigration, every controversial topic there is. I've never felt the kind of deranged tension I feel right now. For every sentence I write, there are people on one side accusing me of being complicit in a genocide and people on the other side accusing me of contributing to the killing and hatred of Jews. For anyone speaking on this topic publicly, the environment is so untenable, so unhelpful, so fraught that it's no wonder we're seeing protests like this play out on college campuses. It makes me want to simultaneously run to my corner of like-minded people and also just shut up and disappear. Number two. A very, very large part of me does not care at all about what is happening on these campuses. I understand these students are future leaders or the next generation, but we should remember what it's like to be their age. I went to college not that long ago. I barely remember it. When I was a teenager, I was still learning not to call things gay that I didn't like. In college, I thought Natty Ice was a good beer and Barack Obama was going to unite the country. In 10 years, those kids are going to look back on some of their ideas and actions now and think they were idiots. I'm sure in 10 years, I'll look back on some of the things I believe now and laugh. 20-year-olds are not wizened foreign policy experts. 20-year-olds are 20-year-olds. I'm interested in their opinions, but they don't keep me up at night. They are growing, evolving, ignorant young adults who deserve space to be wrong and screw up. That's what college is about. When I see 30 college kids from NYU chanting "From the River to the Sea," a chant that means vastly different things to different people, it ranks as about the 212th most important or notable or interesting thing I saw that hour, let alone that day or week or month. I do not know why we continue to focus on these kids so much or call for ruining their careers or insist we need to send in the troops. I hate feeling like I'm falling into the trap by giving the protests any more coverage in this podcast. Number three. If I were thinking about the war in Gaza and ranking the importance of the actions of Hamas and the Israeli government on a scale of 1 to 100, I would put them both somewhere in the 90 to 100 range. If I were ranking the importance of what was happening on a half dozen elite college campuses in the US on the same scale, I'd score them less than 5. Yet, in the context of this conflict, both receive about the same amount of media coverage in the United States. I have no idea how to reconcile this. I'm happy to say that we've covered the former a lot more than the latter, but I can't figure out the obsession from so many reporters and pundits on both the left and the right. Number four, all students have a right to protest. In fact, I encourage them to protest. You should find some time to study too, but movements like the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, the BDS movement, are perfectly rational ways to protest Israel. I hope the BDS movement fails because I oppose its goal. I sometimes scoff at it because I do not think getting Colombia to rid itself of some $200,000 investment in an Israeli company is going to meaningfully change anything, not to mention genuine divestment is easier said than done. I do not think Columbia University, its professors, its dean, or anyone on its faculty are quote-unquote complicit in anything Israel's war cabinet decides to do 7,000 miles away. I actually find the idea to be pretty silly. But guess what? It is a nonviolent form of protest that offers tangible action for genuine objections to policy. When you criminalize or stifle nonviolent protests like that, you often get violent protests. This is one thread of the story of the pro-Palestine activists. Many of the nonviolent, peaceful demonstrators end up being criminalized, silenced, or killed. Criminalizing or trying to destroy movements like BDS is therefore dangerous and counterproductive. Argue with them if you like, but let them be. Number five, student activism is a great way to learn and participate in democracy. Nonviolent student activism is excellent. It is legal. It is not and should not be a violation of school rules. At the same time, if you're a student and your school makes simple rules about student protest, like say, you can't protest on this lawn or at this time, and then you break those rules, you should be prepared to get suspended or arrested. Schools are responsible for not making rules so arduous they effectively restrict or end student activism, and students are responsible for following reasonable rules. Columbia's initial update to their rules on protesting were overly restrictive, and they were rightly criticized. Then, they set some reasonable rules that ensured students could attend class without too much interruption, and many of the protesters intentionally violated those new rules, so they got in trouble. Number 6. I've never, ever felt my own Jewishness more acutely and never felt so surrounded by anti-Semitism more definitively. I know there is a difference between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. I preach that difference. Many of the pro-Palestine protesters at Columbia and on these campuses are, in fact, Jewish. But in the last few months, I'm telling you that I have seen more videos of blatant anti-Semitism and more social media posts from friends that promote anti-Semitic ideas than ever before in my entire life. My perspective on how many people out there hate Jews or see us as evil, self-righteous, conniving people feel like it's been shifted in an irretrievable way. I am not typically prone to these kinds of thoughts or feelings, so I cannot imagine how other Jews who are prone to those thoughts are feeling. This is deeply disturbing to me. Number 7. There are some genuinely frightening things happening on or around Columbia's campus. We need to delineate between students and outside protesters who show up and do awful things. For instance, a video has been widely circulated of pro-Palestine protests outside Columbia University cheering on the militant leaders of Hamas and calling for the bombing of Tel Aviv, a city of 500,000 Jews, Muslims, Arabs, and Israelis. These are violent threats that should not be tolerated anywhere on a college campus. They are representative of a thread of the extremist pro-Palestine movement that I find incredibly frightening. Still, as far as I can tell, those aren't students, and they don't appear to be on campus, so let's not conflate the two. Number 8. That doesn't mean students aren't doing some objectively awful things on Columbia's campus. There are videos and firsthand accounts of Jewish students being assaulted, told to go back to Poland, or prohibited from entering spaces on their own campus. This is an affront to both the safety and the freedom of Jewish students, and the university president must ensure that those students can participate in campus life freely. That a campus rabbi feels the need to warn Jewish students they aren't safe on campus is quite frightening. Number 9. There are some genuinely embarrassing videos of pro-Israel people trying to make innocent things look violent or make themselves into victims. For instance, a pro-Israel account tweeted a video of a bunch of protesters cheerfully dancing in a circle and called it, quote, a cult-like tribal dance, end quote. Another ex-user posted a video of a woman in a shirt that said Jew with a Star of David painted onto it, standing in the middle of protesters while precisely zero people pay her any mind or care that she is there. Then there's the Israeli professor at Columbia, Shai Davidai, who makes me very uncomfortable. He seems to seek out cameras, viral moments, and confrontation as much as he can to get attention, clicks, and social media clout. Victimization porn is becoming more and more common in our country, but I assure you, there are enough bad actors out there that no one needs to manufacture any additional tension. Number 10. I can't believe I have to say this, but the vast majority of students protesting on these campuses are probably just good kids who feel horrified by the things they're seeing happening in Gaza. It's really that simple. They log onto social media and see videos and feel compelled to do something, anything. That is a human and normal and empathetic reaction to war. War is horrific. Many of us become numb to it as we age, but we shouldn't. Having that reaction doesn't make them evil, Jew-hating terrorist lovers. Even the ones doing or saying the worst things are almost certainly retrievable, having followed a good impulse into a dark territory. As of this morning, many of the protesters are now cooperating with the school to break down tents and keep non-students off campus. Isolating and demonizing these kids now in response to their earnest commitment to a cause will only radicalize them further. Number 11. I've said this before, but I'll say it again. In the news, we are inundated with stories of protests, clashes, and division. There are never headlines that read, quote, peaceful day on 99% of U.S. college campuses, even though that headline could have also run yesterday. There was no front page story about the Palestinian and Israeli who both lost relatives in this conflict and then shared a TED stage together last week. The people who organize interfaith meetings to have dialogue about the conflict don't get invited onto CNN or Fox News. Most of us will learn the names of Israel's war cabinet or the head of Hamas's military wing, but far fewer will learn about the people leading peace negotiations and ceasefire deals. This is how things are, and I hate it, but don't be fooled into thinking the entire world is burning with animosity. It isn't. And finally, number 12. All of this campus obsession is distracting from the actual war that is going on in Gaza right now. When we covered Israel's strike that killed workers from the World Central Kitchen, I said it was just one example of how continuing this war is going to do long-term damage to Israel's image and thus Israel's future, which is core to my quote-unquote Zionist case for a ceasefire argument. I have to point out that the unrest and division this war is causing in the U.S. is also part of the Zionist case for a ceasefire. It is part of what I mean when I say this war is making Jews across the globe less safe. Animosity toward Israel is sometimes just anti-Zionism. It is sometimes anti-Semitism. And sometimes anti-Zionism morphs into anti-Semitism before our eyes. Along with the 11 other thoughts above, one sad takeaway I have from all of this is that my worst fears about what would happen without a ceasefire continue to come true. We'll be right back after this quick break. All right, that is it for my take. As I mentioned at the top, we're skipping today's reader question because the podcast got a little bit long. Next up is our Under the Radar section. Pennsylvania held its presidential primary yesterday with very little fanfare, as victories for both President Biden and former President Trump were preordained. However, one surprising storyline emerged from the vote. Roughly 16% of GOP voters cast a ballot for Nikki Haley, despite the Republican primary being over for more than a month. Pennsylvania is considered the key to the White House in 2024, and whichever candidate wins there will have the easiest path to winning the election. In 2020, Biden won it by about 80,000 votes. In 2016, Trump won it by about 68,000 votes. On Tuesday, Haley received over 156,000 votes. Axios has the story, and there's a link to it in today's episode description. Next up is our numbers section. The percentage of Jewish college students in the U.S. who say they experienced or saw anti-Semitic incidents during their first semester of the 2023-2024 school year was 73%. The percentage of Jewish college students who said they felt comfortable with others on their campus knowing they're Jewish after October 7th was 39%. The number of incidents of Islamophobia on U.S. campuses reported to the group Muslim Campus Life since October 7th was 100. The percentage of Muslim students who say they felt personally in danger on their campus after October 7th was 52%, according to a March 2024 survey of campuses by the University of Chicago's Project on Security and Threats. The percentage of students who reported attending a march or protest on behalf of Palestinians in the 2 months following October 7th was 11%. The percentage of students who reported attending a march or protest on behalf of Israel in the 2 months following October 7th was 6%. The percentage of Americans aged 18 to 24 who said they had a favorable view of Israel in 2023 was 64%, according to Gallup. The percentage of Americans aged 18 to 24 who said they had a favorable view of Israel in 2024 was 38%. All right, and last but not least, our Have a Nice Day story. Recent polling from the Associated Press shows that Americans are not as divided as we may think. While political division is entrenched in our government institutions and our media sphere, and divides are deep on certain issues, Americans overwhelmingly agree on the most fundamental things. Over 90% of adults AP surveyed said that the right to equal protection under the law, the right to vote, and freedom of speech are important to the country's identity. Even the right to bear arms, an often divisive principle, is deemed important or somewhat important by 78% of people. Axios has the story, and there's a link to it in today's episode description. All right, everybody, that is it for today's podcast. Tough one today. As you can tell, I care a lot about this stuff and getting a little frustrated with how things are going. But as always, If you want to write in with some feedback or thoughts, you can reach me, Isaac, I-S-A-A-C, at readtangle.com. And if you want to support our work and keep this podcast going, you can go to readtangle.com and click the little membership button at the top and become a member. We'll be right back here same time tomorrow. Have a good one. Peace. Our podcast is written by me, Isaac Saul, and edited and engineered by John Wall. The script is edited by our managing editor, Ari Weitzman, Will Kaback, Bailey Saul, and Sean Brady. The logo for our podcast was designed by Magdalena Bakova, who is also our social media manager. Music for the podcast was produced by Diet 75. And if you're looking for more from Tangle, please go to readtangle.com and check out our website.